From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Today, there is no federal or state restriction on how much PFAS contamination is allowed in our drinking water. There is an advisory, though, and we'll talk to the person who oversaw it.
We know that just a single exposure to one of those chemicals at a critical time in development can produce an adverse effect.
Microplastics have been found in Great Lakes craft beers, and it's not just the plastic we should be worried about.
Another problem is that we found in marine environments, at least, these plastic particles are very good at absorbing chemicals from the water.
We'll talk to a Michigan adoptee who's been fighting the system that hid his birth records.
Even though I knew my birth mother, her family, my birth father's family, for nearly three decades, they still refused to give me my birth certificate in 1989.
Plus, we'll have a tiny Great Lakes to Great Lakes summit with an African researcher. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. More than 50 municipal water supplies in Michigan have trace amounts of PFAS chemicals in them. There is no federal or state restriction on how much PFAS contamination can be allowed before it's considered a public health threat. What there is an advisory. It was issued in 2016 by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. We're going to talk to the person who oversaw that work. Betsy Sutherland is a member of the Environmental Protection Network and former director of the Office of Science and Technology in EPA's Office of Water. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
So let's take this one step at a time. Why is there concern about PFAS chemicals being in the water?
We have, unfortunately, actual human data that shows that when people are exposed to these chemicals, there's a relationship with a lot of health effects. And that was done, the DuPont company did that study in more than 65,000 people in a mid-Ohio valley, both in West Virginia and Ohio, were exposed to high levels of PFOA in their drinking water supplies. And they have studied these people for several years to see what kind of health effects they have.
Yeah, we should clarify, PFOA is one of the many PFAS chemicals in that family. When that 2016 EPA advisory was issued, your team recommended setting a lifetime health exposure for PFAS at 70 parts per trillion. How did you arrive at that level?
We did a very thorough analysis of the world's literature on all the studies that had been done, both on animals and humans, exposure to PFOA and to PFOS, just those two types of chemicals. And what we determined is that the animal dosing studies were the most convincing to prove a relationship between the dose of PFOA and PFOS that the animals got and the effect on their development of their pups. So we use the developmental effects of these two toxins to create our health advisory for people.
Clarify something for me. When you say a lifetime health exposure, does that mean the water you drink presently should not have more than 70 parts per trillion, or does that mean all the water I drink in a lifetime should not add up to 70 parts per trillion because it bioaccumulates in my body?
So it's at any point that you drink that water, it should be at or below the 70 parts per trillion. It turns out that these particular chemicals, PFOA and PFOS, we know that just a single exposure to one of those chemicals at a critical time in development can produce an adverse effect and furthermore can result in a body burden that stays with you for years. So our lifetime value is also protective of short-term exposures.
Now, PFOA and PFOS, the most common PFAS chemicals, right?
That's correct.
But I've been told by the Union of Concerned Scientists there might be up to 4,700 variations of these chemicals. Could we be missing a large part of the exposure?
Absolutely. And that's what EPA and the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry are really devoting their future efforts is to look at a lot of these other chemicals. It turned out that there were about eight companies in the United States that agreed to phase out any manufacture of PFOA and PFOS by 2015, and they have done that. Again, that was voluntary, but they have done that. However, in the meantime, first of all, we're still able to import those chemicals in consumer products that are manufactured in other countries. And secondly, those companies switched to some variations of PFOA and PFAS, which we now are concerned may have some similar health effects.
So this is that switch from what they call long-chain PFAS chemicals to short-chain PFAS chemicals. Can you explain what that means and why it might make a difference?
Right. So the PFOA and PFAS all had 8 carbon atoms attached to fluorine and some other chemicals. That made them long chain. They have come up with additional chemicals that have carbon and fluorine with much fewer carbon atoms, but they still have that same water and grease resistant property that the 8 carbon chain PFOA and PFAS had.
The Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry came up with a report recently that set the health advisory for PFAS chemicals, that is PFOA and PFOS, at a combined 18 parts per trillion rather than your advisory of 70 parts per trillion. You question their methodology. Why?
I really think it's a very clear-cut difference, and I'm so hoping that EPA and ATSDR will move rapidly to resolve this issue for the public, because I know how painful it is for communities to have this confusing difference in the recommendations from 2 federal agencies. So here's what the difference is. In the case of PFOA, we selected at EPA only studies where the animals were exposed to at least 2 doses of PFOA. In the case of ATSDR, they selected studies that had only a single dose exposure to PFOA. Now, the reason we selected ones with 2 or more, the whole point of these animal toxicity studies is to see how the health effects change as the dose changes. So from our perspective at EPA, when you had an animal study where only a single dose was given, you really couldn't evaluate whether that dose was close to a no effect level or was in some effect level, then preventing you from determining what was the real, you know, threshold for any detrimental effects. That's the only difference between EPA's PFOA number and ATSDR's.
So go ahead.
In the case of PFAS, there's even less of a difference. In that case, ATSDR used the exact same animal dosing study that EPA used. The difference there was they decided they wanted to add an additional reduction of a factor of 10 to that number. That's why they come up with the recommendation of 7 parts per trillion rather than 70. And they did that because they said, well, we are concerned there's a lack of data on the effects that PFAS has on immune systems. And so to make sure we're protecting for that effect that was not studied, we're going to add this factor of 10 to the number that we recommend. In EPA's case, we did not add an additional margin of safety on the PFAS number, even though we had the same finding that there is no data on the immunotoxicity of PFAS. I think it's important that people put heat on EPA and ATSDR to resolve these differences.
They might differ, but we've got these 2 advisories calling for PFAS exposure to be limited. Should the U.S. EPA go ahead and issue some kind of preliminary PFAS limit for drinking water and say you can't have over this amount, whether it's 70 or 18 or whatever it might be?
I think that's impossible from a regulatory standpoint. The Safe Drinking Water Act is quite clear that there's a very prescribed process. It's a multi-year process for setting up a drinking water standard that applies to public water utilities throughout the United States.
I want to get into that a little bit, but some states such as New Jersey, Minnesota, New Hampshire have already set limits or are about to set limits for PFAS chemicals in water. What do you think of those decisions?
Absolutely. States are free to do that, and they are able to do that because they are not constrained by the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. EPA must follow the prescribed process in the Safe Drinking Water Act. So that act allowed us to put out this recommendation, this drinking water health advisory, with all the necessary information to provide for utilities to use and implement this number. But it did not provide us with the authority to put out a mandatory drinking water standard unless we go through this, you know, multi-year prescribed process.
So here's where we're at, as I understand it. We've got these two advisories that differ. We're only measuring two of the thousands of PFAS chemicals. I don't know that we've done anything to actually start the real process of determining what's called a maximum contaminant level for just these two. Waiting for the science to work it out is not what people want to hear. They want to hear the water's safe to drink, the fish are safe to eat. What's the short-term solution here?
Well, I'm hoping that we're going to get great information from EPA in December of this year. Right now, they're planning to put out a management plan where they're going to give a lot of information responding to all these listening sessions that they had throughout the country this summer and fall. I guess Michigan just had their meeting with EPA.
So yeah, they had one at the insistence of some members of Congress and then didn't allow public comment.
Oh, that's very disappointing. Well, I was hoping that management plan will answer some of these issues for communities, because that really is the end result of the listening sessions that they conducted this year.
Betsy Sutherland is a member of the Environmental Protection Network and former director of the Office of Science and Technology and EPA's Office of Water. Thanks very much for taking the time to explain all this to us.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come, why Henry Ford, despite his anti-Semitism, worked so closely with the architect Albert Kahn, a German-born Jewish immigrant.
Ford and Kahn seemed to understand one another. They were each uneducated men. Kahn never went beyond elementary school. Henry Ford was disdainful of men with college degrees.
That's up next. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The Detroit skyline and the University of Michigan would not be the same if it weren't for one of Detroit's famous architects. Albert Kahn left his mark in Michigan, and as you'll hear, he also left his mark on the Soviet Union. Michael Hodges covers fine arts for the Detroit News. He's also the author of the book Building the Modern World, Albert Kahn in Detroit. We originally aired this conversation with Hodges back in August. Take a listen. So first, to give everybody an idea of what we're talking about, tick through a list of Kahn buildings in Detroit.
Kahn built a large share of what we consider old Detroit. So it's the Fisher Building. It's the General Motors Building. It's the Detroit Athletic Club, both newspaper buildings, and also the old Detroit Times building, which has been torn down.
How about on the University of Michigan campus?
Well over half of what we consider the old part of the university, Hill Auditorium, Natural Sciences, the Graduate Library, the Engineering Building with the Arch, Clements Library.
So that's a lot. How did this impoverished German Jewish immigrant kid end up as a revolutionary architect of manufacturing plants, too, we should mention, and buildings on a grand scale like you just described?
Kahn was lucky when he arrived in the United States from Luxembourg, actually, at age 12. His family was dirt poor, but his mother managed to get him a job in an architect's office, unpaid.
At age 12.
At 13, yeah, right. Unpaid for the first year. He eventually landed in the distinguished architecture firm of Mason and Rice when he was 13 or 14.
It was a rocky way of getting there, right? Though he's had a couple of stumbles in his architecture career, right?
Yeah, first he was working for the John L. Scott Company. Scott built the old Wayne County Courthouse near Campus Martius. And Kahn had a job before he went to the architecture office every morning rubbing down two horses So basically, this little unwashed German would show up reeking of the stable, and the Scot people eventually heaved him out with insults. I have often thought that several years later, they probably realized they made an incredible mistake.
I'll bet.
Kahn did a lot of important work for Henry Ford, early work for Henry Ford. Well, let's talk about first what he did for him, because it's significant and changed things for a lot of the way we built factories.
Kahn starts working for Henry Ford about 1908, working on the Highland Park plant. Henry Ford noticed Kahn because he had built the famous building number 10 at the Packard motor car plant on Detroit's east side. Kahn builds pretty much everything at Highland Park. But the most important building is the building that got torn down, which was the original automotive assembly building, which had so much glass in it that it was immediately nicknamed the Crystal Palace by Detroiters.
Now, Ford was a virulent anti-Semite, and here we've got a guy who's comes from a Jewish family. How did they get along?
Yeah, comes from a Jewish family, and his father was a rabbi. Ford and Kahn seemed to understand one another. They were each uneducated men. Kahn never went beyond elementary school. Henry Ford was disdainful of men with college degrees. And in Kahn, he seems to have found somebody who spoke the same pragmatic language that Henry Ford liked. They got along, as far as I can tell, quite well. Kahn ends up doing almost everything for Ford around the country, you know, forever, basically, up through the 30s.
He basically tolerated that anti-Semitism because it was very public. He used to put out a paper about his views on the Jewish world.
Yes. Ford's anti-Semitism doesn't become public, as I understand it, until about 1915. That is, it doesn't get radiated out to the public when he blames World War I on Jewish financiers. But it explodes into the public view in 1920 with the anti-Semitic series in Ford's newspaper, the weekly Dearborn Independent, which was called The International Jew, the World's Problem.
Albert Kahn designed hundreds of factories for the Soviet Union. How did he get tapped for that?
The Soviets sent a delegation in the mid to late 20s to basically scope out who was the best industrial architect in America that they could import. And largely because of the Ford factories, they pick Albert Kahn. He gets hired as the chief consulting architect for the Kremlin's first five-year plan and has an office in Moscow with 25 men from Detroit from 1929 to 31. In those years, he builds the lion's share, well over half, of the industrial capacity that would end up enabling the Soviets to defeat the Nazis in World War II.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that. How significant was that? I mean, why do you say that?
The Kahn firm built over 500 factories in the 2.5 years that they're in the Soviet Union. They design and oversee the construction of them all across, both in the Asian and European halves of the country. Now, Kahn was building tractor plants and cement plants and electrical plants and whatnot, but all of those end up being converted, just like his factories in the United States, to war production in the late 30s.
And prior to that moment, the Soviet Union was basically agricultural and in the 19th century still, or farther back.
Russia was the most profoundly backward country in Europe. So really what the Soviets were trying to do was sort of this blitzkrieg industrialization overnight.
Let's go back to the Detroit. You tell the story about a backlash against the Diego Rivera murals at the Detroit Institute of Arts and how Albert Kahn played a role in saving them. Now, it's hard to understand because those are beloved murals today, right? Who didn't like them at the time?
The bourgeoisie, people with money who were appalled that their restful garden court at the DIA had been disfigured with pictures of grimy factories.
And by a socialist on top of that.
And by a guy who's trying to get back in the good graces of the Mexican Communist Party.
What was Kahn's role in saving those murals?
Kahn was on the Arts Commission that governed the DIA for the city when it was owned by the city, along with Edsel Ford, who was a very good friend of Kahn's. In some respects, Kahn was a mentor to the younger Edsel Ford. There was an controversy that erupted when the murals were first unveiled. A large group of conservative religious figures attacked one of the panels, the vaccination panels, as being blasphemous and anti-Christian. The day after the unveiling, Kahn gave an interview to my newspaper, the Detroit News, which, interestingly, we buried in the middle of the front section. But he basically said that anyone who didn't recognize that Mr. Rivera had put Detroit on the world artistic map was adult. He could be a little peppery when he was confronted with what he regarded as patent stupidity.
The Fisher Building in Detroit is a favorite of Instagram photographers and considered a real gem of Art Deco. But you write the building was never fully realized. What do you mean by that?
The Fisher Building was initially supposed to be this humongous project with three towers. The tower that we have was supposed to be the easternmost. It's not even the center tower. On the western edge, a block and a half or two blocks away, was going to be an identical tower to the Fisher Building. And in between was going to be a 50 or 60-story tower that the two would bookend.
Wow. Okay.
But the Depression got in the way. So the Fisher brothers end up just building the Fisher Building and then the new center building behind it, which is now called the Albert Kahn Building.
The book is Building the Modern World, Albert Kahn in Detroit. The author is Michael Hodges. Thanks for putting this book together for us.
Thank you.
This is Lester Graham. You know, when I'm not here on Stateside, I'm working for Michigan Radio's Environment Report. I've spent a fair amount of my career covering the Great Lakes, the North American Great Lakes. Right now, we're going to have a tiny Great Lakes to Great Lakes summit. My guest is Kevin Obiero. He's the director of Kenya's Marine and Fisheries Research Institute. He's in the U.S. to offer his insight into the African Great Lakes with researchers studying the North American Great Lakes. Welcome.
Thank you, Lester, for having me.
So how similar are the African Great Lakes to the North American Great Lakes?
First, apart from their size, we find that these lakes host of diverse, valuable resources that are supporting the lives of thousands of people. In terms of economics, they really play a great deal in terms of benefiting the GDP of the countries. But apart from that, they are also similar in terms of their cross-national. You find that they cut across three or four nations. Like in the case of the African Great Lakes, it's more of like 11 nations. So there's an umbilical cord that is tying some of these lakes together. And you look at also the economics part of it, they are playing a very crucial part. And then environmentally, these lakes are also very, very crucial for sustaining some of the unique biota that are in some of these lakes.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. In our Great Lakes, there are threats of invasive species, loss of wetland habitat where the fish breed, agricultural, chemical, sewer plant spills. What kind of threats are there to the African Great Lakes?
Similar, I can categorize them into five categories. If I start with the environmental aspects, we have issues of pollution and eutrophication, a lot of rivers flowing in with a lot of nutrients. So over time, you have nitrogen and phosphorus levels so high, leading to algal blooms. That is now the ecological aspects leading to algal blooms is now a major challenge. Thick mat of green algae floating.
We're familiar with that.
Sure. And then you look at now the ecological aspects. There's been biodiversity loss. But looking at it, your flip side also, you have invasions coming in. I know the North American Great Lakes are dealing with the sea lampreys.
Yeah.
In our context, we're dealing with the Nile Perch. This was a species that was introduced in the 1950s. It was able to ecologically, you know, occupy a large percentage of the ecological niche over the years. But apart from causing the ecological, you know, disturbance, it was also like an economic savior in that it brought in a lot of, you know, economic resources. This is a fish that is highly traded, over 600,000 USD per year. So it's as you may try to look at it as an ecological disaster, it is also an economic savior. So we are still grappling with how to, what side.
We're familiar with that problem as well. So the economy of the North American Great Lakes is important because it's a water highway for cargo ships. And I know there's cargo ships on the African Great Lakes as well.
Yes.
Fishing, of course, as you've been talking about, tourism, drinking water for something like 40 million people around the North American Great Lakes, among other things.
Yes.
How important are the African Great Lakes to the economy of the nations that border the lakes?
First of all, you will look at the This is the epicenter of the population. So a lot of settlement, people coming into the lakes. So this is like one of it is livelihoods. Over 30 million people depend on the African Great Lakes, for example. That is the Lake Victoria Basin alone. So if you ever to extend it to the other seven African Great Lakes, it is over 50 million people depending on these resources. Secondly, they provide power. You have power generation. Like now, Lake Victoria, through Jinja, it offers a lot of power. Looking at Malawi context also, the water bodies also lead to the Victoria Falls, which is very, very good for touristic. So you have a lot of ecotourism, a lot of people coming in, enjoying a good time, but at the same time, finding you know the ecotourism and also the ecological aspects. So it brings in a lot of economic aspects, the ecotourism, and also supporting diverse livelihoods. So in terms of livelihoods, I mean, can you be able to eat cheap protein food that is good, especially for the first 5 years? It is good to have, you know, the best protein source, which is cheap and easily available.
Now, I have visited an area that is far south where, of you.
Yes.
I was on the south end of Lake Malawi,
yes.
A little place called Monkey Bay, and I was talking to environmental journalists there. They were telling me that there were concerns because it was being overfished,
yes.
And they were trying to get some of the people who were fishing all year long to
yes.
stop and maybe raise bees, keep
yes.
bees for
yes.
honey and things like that. How have people been able to adapt to other careers or supplemental careers
yes.
when they were pretty reliant on subsistence fishing?
Yeah, this is something that we have been dealing with over the years because as people come together close to these lakes, there's over exploitation. And definitely this leads to low catch. So you spend more of your time catching little. So you have to find an alternative. So I think development agencies and also the local communities are now realizing that what can we diversify? Beekeeping is one crucial aspect because you look at the economics aspect of it. It brings in more money. For example, a kilo of honey is worth a kilo of fish. So that one you are able to now buy. So these alternative livelihoods are now helping people to even buy the essential, you know, nets. Because if you are relying on the small fishes, they are not able to regenerate back. So if you are able to get another money elsewhere, then you can be able to buy legal nets, which can now be used for fishing. So the alternative is very, very crucial.
One of the things I was reading about is that there's a greater concern about global warming
yes.
with the African Great Lakes.
Yes.
What kind of impact are you seeing?
We are seeing major, you know, flooding taking place. In some seasons also, we have major droughts which are taking place. Previously, we used to know that this is the season of planting crops, but now has totally been distorted. So you are expecting to plant in February, and the rains come as late as March. So it distorts the natural cycle of how to do things. Then there is the how do we adapt to these measures? Sometimes it destroys the very, very livelihood. For example, the infrastructure. During flooding, a lot of, you know, roads are cleared. A lot of people lose their lives and also their property.
Can the research that you and your colleagues are conducting
yes.
in the African Great Lakes and the research being done here help both continents find some ways to help both sets of Great Lakes and keep them in better shape?
Sure, Lester. One important thing is that as we have seen, we are grappling with the same challenges. So we need to find common solutions to some of these challenges. The North American Great Lakes have this lake committee system. Can we harmonize our system? Secondly, is in terms of capacity building. You need expertise to improve on understanding data collection, long-term data collection, so that we can understand the trends and then now give better policy, you know, measures. So one way of bringing this, you know, these two organizations together, that is the African Research Institution and educational institutions coming together and partnering in terms of resource sharing. We have infrastructure, for example, down there. Can they come with their equipment? We use one of our boats to collect the data, which now long-term can be able to help us to understand the climatic impacts. Because these climatic, the models, as you are trying to develop them, we have global models, but you need to have local models which will help you to understand the rainfall patterns. When are we going to, for example, rain? So this one will help now people to know, when am I going to plant my crops? When am I going to adapt to, you know, some of these emerging challenges that we have? So I think bringing together this transboundary and disciplinary aspect has been a wealth of experience for us, and that is where the direction we are moving to. Through ACARE, that is the African Center for Aquatic Research and Education, we are now forming lasting and long-term vision. We want to bring in the African partners and let's come together and say, planning for 5 years may be good, but it's not good enough. So can we plan for like 10 years and 15 years? Because the SDGs are 15-year plans. They are 20-year plan. And climate change cannot be understood within a cycle of 2 years. So we want to now extend our thinking towards, 5, 10-year, 15-year plan.
Kevin Obiero is the director of Kenya's Marine and Fisheries Research Institute. I want to thank you for coming in, and best of luck working with the African Center for Aquatic Research and Education here.
Thank you. It was a pleasure having me, and I thank you for this opportunity. Sure enough, we shall make an attempt to visit you again.
Coming up, if you're a fan of Great Lakes craft brews, you might enjoy the taste, the aroma, maybe even the buzz, but how about the microplastics?
Some of the major concerns are some of the plasticizers that might be added to plastics. Plastics themselves may be inert, but they have things like phthalates and bisphenol A, colorants, UV stabilizers in them.
The bad news about good beer. That's in 10 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. I am a fan of Michigan craft beer. When I learned of a study which found microplastic fibers in Great Lakes beers, it got my attention. In fact, it felt worth revisiting. Mary Kasuth conducted the study, and we originally aired our conversation in June of this year. Here it is again. So how do microplastics get into the environment? What's the source?
All kinds of ways they can get into the environment. A lot of it just comes from our overall production, which has grown at a staggering rate. In the 1970s, global production was around 30 million tons, and by 2016, according to Plastic Europe, we were generating about 335 million tons globally.
Of plastic.
Yep. So a lot of the stuff is just, we might throw it away. A small portion of it might be incinerated. An even smaller portion might be recycled. But the vast majority of it, almost 80%, is landfilled. And so this just continues to break down. So it's not really terribly shocking when we find it in consumer products or water.
Do these plastics affect human health?
That's a great question. Some of the major concerns are some of the plasticizers that might be added to plastics. Plastics themselves may be inert, but they have things like phthalates and bisphenol A, colorants, UV stabilizers in them.
And some of those are endocrine disruptors, right?
That's right, and that could be an issue. Another problem is that we found in marine environments, at least, these plastic particles are very good at adsorbing chemicals from the water. So things like PCBs, DDT, brominated flame retardants, things like these can actually form a coating on the outside of the plastic particles, which means that we would be ingesting higher amounts of that.
Okay, your study was limited to Great Lakes beers. What kind of limitations on the water? Was this Great Lakes region, or was this definitely from the Great Lakes through a municipal system?
The actual beers that we selected drew water from the Great Lakes, and the reason we decided to do that is a study that came out in 2014 looked at 24 brands of German beer. We wanted to see if that was just a regional problem or if it's in something that we might be suffering from in our neck of the woods as well. So we looked at beers that drew their waters from the Great Lakes, and then we tested the tap water from those regions as well to see if there was any correlation between the amount of plastics we found in the beer and the amount of plastics we found in the tap water.
How did that compare?
Surprisingly, there was no correlation. So that leads us to believe that perhaps the particles are actually getting in through the beer-making process and not from the source water. But we need more research.
Were there any plastics in the source water?
Yes, there were small amounts. Mm-hmm. But they didn't correspond with the amounts that were in the beer.
That's interesting. So you mentioned that study about German beers. Are Great Lakes beers any worse or better than other beers?
Well, according to our averages, we actually had fewer plastic particles in our study for beer than they did.
Are the brewers of the Great Lakes region aware of microplastics in their beers?
I suppose they are now. because to my knowledge, we have never tested American beers before. So this is kind of a new thing. We didn't publish any of the actual names of the breweries because we don't intend to shame anybody. But we just want evidence that it's there. As long as we know that there's a problem, then we can kind of take some action to protect ourselves from it. But the first step, of course, is trying to figure out if there's a problem at all.
Where did these breweries actually get their water? Which lakes are we talking about?
Oh, all five of the Great Lakes. There were three from Superior, four from Michigan. There was, I believe, only one from Lake Huron, two from Erie, and two from Ontario.
So if we're getting more plastics in the brewing process, any idea where that plastic might be coming from?
We don't really know yet because the beer making process or the salt making process or any of the other beverages that we consume, if we find plastic in them, it hasn't really been studied yet. But that is something that I'm hoping to work on in the very near future.
So why did you choose beer over something like bottled water from a municipal system that uses Great Lakes?
So our study had three components, beer, salt, and tap water. And we decided to study beer and salt because each of those had already been tested in other research facilities. And so those were sort of me-too studies to see if we would end up with the same results that they came up with. And then we also started working with this organization called Orb Media. They had all of the resources to gather tap water samples, and so that's kind of how our tap water study came into being. Very soon after my paper was published, my research advisor, Dr. Sam Mason in Fredonia, New York, she actually published a paper that looked at bottled water. So this is kind of a new area of research. There's so many things that one could look at. We just decided to choose those three things.
I'm curious what that bottled water study says, because the impulse is to say, okay, if the tap water has plastic in it, I'll drink bottled water. What did it show?
It's not any better. She looked at 11 brands of bottled water. There were more than 250 samples that she tested. And she used a different method than my method for tap water. But if you compare the same size that I was looking at, there were actually twice as many plastic particles in bottled water than there was in tap water.
There's something really ironic about getting plastic bottled water that has plastic in it because you want to get away from the tap water that has plastic in it.
Right, right. So this is obviously a problem that we can't really filter our way out of. Buying bottled water is only going to contribute to the problem further. So we just need to really have a conversation, a national and maybe international conversation, about the single-use disposable plastic that has just become so convenient and so common that we don't even think about it anymore.
If there are microplastics in tap water or in our beer from Great Lakes, and there is clearly, what can we do about that at home? Is there a way to filter the water or filter the beer? Although I don't know I want to bother filtering my beer, but can they do it at the brewery? Is there some way we can strain this stuff out?
Again, our municipal, at least in Minneapolis, our municipal water system, they do an excellent job of filtering these things out. And so, you know, the water that you get out of your tap might be pretty clean of all of these things, but even this material is so ubiquitous. I mean, I'm wearing a synthetic jacket right now, and it's made out of polymers, you know, and just by, like, standing next to my water cup here and abrading the sleeve, I could be releasing plastic particles that end up getting into my cup. So I think there really isn't a great way to deal with this unless we talk about the sources.
Marika Suth is an assistant professor of environmental science at Dunwoody College of Technology. She conducted the study as a student at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. Hey, thanks for telling us. Not great news, but thanks anyway.
Yeah, thanks for helping us tell our story.
You don't know how lucky you are. That's the title of a book by a Michigan man who's been fighting the system that hid his birth records. Why? Because he's an adoptee. We originally broadcast my conversation with Rudy Owens in June of this year. He joined the show to talk about his journey through the American adoption system. Let's take a listen. Why did you write this memoir?
Well, I think it's important for Americans to understand the adoptee experience. We number about 5 million people in the United States. And then when you think of that, there's at least 5 million birth mothers. And everyone has siblings who might have adoptee relatives or know someone who's adopted someone. So we are a large part of this country whose stories mainly remain hidden in the shadow. What I wanted to do is remove the stigma associated with the adoptee experience and help people understand why adoptees today in the year 2018 are fighting at least to get access to their identity records so they can know who they are. It's an important story. It's a civil rights story. It's an equal rights story. I think it's time that story get told openly and honestly.
I would think knowing something about your biological past and your health traits might be important too.
Oh, it's absolutely critical. Nearly every medical expert, the Surgeon General and other major medical organizations always recommend knowing your family medical history. Think about the BRCA gene for women who may have a probability of cancer. There are adoptee women who may never know they have a higher risk of cancer just because they may be born in some state where they can't get those records. So if we do believe in promoting population health and human health and individual health, it seems to make sense that we would want to ensure that everyone can get their family background.
Let's talk about Michigan. You call Michigan's adoption record law outdated and discriminatory. In what ways?
Well, when I say discriminatory, I basically mean there is a law and it applies to people two different ways. There are people who are adopted and people who are not adopted. When people who are not adopted want to know what their vital records are, including their birth certificate, they fill out a form, they're treated professionally. They pay a fee, they get their document. When someone who is adopted wants to know where they come from, they hit what we call a brick wall, where they hit all kinds of barriers based on their year of birth. And it almost is impossible because of the system to even know what your family origins are or to even get access to your records. There are also two tiers of adoptees in Michigan. I was born in the tier between 1945 and 1980, where I actually have a higher threshold to basically I have to get a court order to get my birth certificate.
Now, wait, if you were born before 45, it's a different set of rules. If you were born after 1980, it's a different set of rules.
That is correct. And I can't tell you the rationale among the lawmakers who did it that way, but we know from the data that these are the boom years of American adoption. There were nearly 3 million adoptions between the years 1945 and 1975. That's when it was the system that promoted it. That's when we had the national system that promoted that as the choice for single mothers.
What is the reason the state, the government, gives you for being so secretive about your personal records?
Well, what I usually hear from the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services is it's the law. I don't hear anything more beyond that. What I just hear is that is the law, and we are here to enforce the law, and you have to abide by the rules. In my case, I had found my birth mother in 1989. I had her sign a consent form that basically stated Michigan could release my birth records to me. Even though I knew my birth mother, her family, my birth father's family, for nearly three decades, they still refused to give me my birth certificate in 1989. In 2016, I asked again. They still refused to give it to me, even though I had a family record of knowing each other. And they made me get a court order, which I got, and finally got my birth certificate.
That's a lot of process. You've got some suggestions for the state of Michigan. Let's go through them.
Right.
First, you say the state should do a better job in providing accurate data on adoptees born here.
Yeah.
That's not done?
No, that is a national problem. What adoption, the counting of adoptees was always voluntary. We had a system that counted adoptees, again, in those big boom years from 1945 to 75. That was voluntary. So what we have is an estimate, a pretty good estimate between those years, that there were nearly 3 million adoptees. Since that time, there has been no official counting of them. The U.S. Census has only been counting them since the year 2000 and then in 2010. And even then, it's not counting adoptees who are adults. So we have this large group of people who were born as adoptees. And I think it's important to have data because when you are counted, you count. And when you count, people pay attention. So Michigan, like other states, can say, well, we don't need to help these people or provide them access because we don't know who they are or how many there are. If we had a better estimate that there was a huge number of Michiganders who are denied some information that others get by law, then people might pay attention to that.
Second, you suggest Michigan should track all requests for birth records by adoptees. How does that help?
Well, I think what we don't know is how many people are asking for help. So what the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services told me when I asked for an interview and then they replied by email is that they're not counting how many requests are coming in. So we don't know how many people are asking for help. What we do know is just some data that they're saying about how much information is released. And again, when you're releasing information, it's only after you've cleared these enormous hurdles, one, that you've miraculously, by luck and by grit, found out what your parents were. In Michigan, birth parents have the ability to redact information if they want through the system. So you, first of all, you've got to find your birth mother. Then you've got to get that person to hopefully sign a consent form.
If she's still living.
If they're around, right, and they could be somewhere else. So it's very difficult. So what would be really helpful, I think, for lawmakers and for everyone else is just to know what the volume is of people coming in, and then we can know what the success rate is or the failure rate. And again, if we find that there's some disparities, maybe we can address those disparities. I think this is pretty much bipartisan in nature. It's just good government Government agencies particularly dedicated to health and human services are great at tracking data. Why can't we track this a little better?
You point to the Central Adoption Registry.
Yeah.
And you call for a performance audit of that office.
Yep.
Why?
Well, it's unusual that because I have written about adoption, people are contacting me around the country who were born. I had a woman contact me in Scotland. I have people contacting me who have some long-term illnesses and others. They say they're born here, but they can't get any help when they try to get help. And the only place you can get help is this office. This is the office that handles requests that come in. They come in from the court. They come in from an adoption agency. They process. They determine whether or not there is information on file that indicates whether a birth parent would release information or not. And if so, then they could possibly release information. But that office isn't there to help an adoptee. If you call, you're not going to talk to anyone. They may call you back. There's no email that you can ask. I born in this circumstance. Here's my question. What can I do? I, in my circumstance, had a situation that I do not believe was covered by law because I had found my birth parents, and theoretically, common sense should dictate my birth certificate should have been given. But she basically said, and it was a one-person office from what I understand, fill out the dang form. And that doesn't seem to me really good customer service when we basically hope government is there to serve the people that put them there.
Finally, you call for the state to provide more staff to answer adoptee questions like you were talking about. How's that going to help everyone?
Well, I think people don't understand what it's like to be an adoptee asking for help. When you go into the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services building in Lansing, which I was this week when I went to visit lawmakers, they stand behind a sealed glass office with a very thick window, and they stand in a very defensive posture. And I actually proposed to them some of these ideas, and they weren't very interested in talking to me. So what I suggested to them and to some state lawmakers who had the benefit of meeting and their staff was what we can do is perhaps free up some staff time, make sure that the staff can at least take questions. You can log questions during the day. You can get an answering machine. You can set up an email where people could send questions in a reasonable amount of time. People can answer those questions in a professional and courteous manner. It's not that way right now with the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, and that's just unfortunate.
Now, when I was looking at your blog, you did send in some questions, and you didn't get all of them answered. You didn't even get half of them answered.
No, I did not.
But you did get answers.
I got some answers.
So it's not completely broken, it sounds like.
No, and those answers, what I was trying to do was just to determine, you know, in my case, like, how did you come to a decision to deny me my birth certificate when all this information was available, when common sense would have dictated it should have been released? And I also wanted information how they were working. So you have to basically go through a reporter-like process, submit questions, and then get an answer. They would not allow anyone who was in the decision-making process to ever talk to me. I thought that was unfortunate since they were the ones making determinations about a document that took me 51 years to get.
And we want to talk about that in just a second, but let's talk about the lawmakers. How did those conversations go? How receptive were they?
Well, I'm going to applaud the Michigan State Legislature staff. Everyone was professional and courteous across the aisle. I talked to Republicans. I talked to Democrats. Their staff were always there to listen. I let them know who I was, why I had flown across the country. I told them about my book. I told them about my experience, and then I told them about simple ways we can make some solutions that don't cost a lot of money and help the residents. Everyone likes something that isn't too confrontational. So I got good treatment. What I heard was from two staff members of at least two lawmakers that their husbands were adopted and had gone through similar experiences. I know one member of the Michigan Senate is an adoptee. I ran into people because I was wearing a T-shirt that said adoptee rights are human rights, have conversations with me. A woman hugged me because she had gone through the exact same experience as me. I ran into a man at my hotel whose sister had given up her child for adoption when she was 17. So people want to talk about it. It gets it out of the shadows. So I think that they like it, but right now it's not on anyone's agenda. There's a lot on the agenda in Lansing right now, and this is not there.
You ultimately did receive a copy of your original birth certificate after the state had refused to hand it over. What changed?
Well, what changed was they had to comply with the law. In this case, they said, go to the court and get a court order. We're not going to talk to you anymore. And I said, okay. That is not an easy process. Going to a court is a very difficult thing. They don't provide any information online how to do that because it's going to be different in different counties. I had to piece it together talking to staff at the at the juvenile court in Wayne County, and I had to fill out three different forms, and then I had a seven-minute hearing with a judge, Judge Dingell, and Judge Dingell ruled in my favor mainly because I had known my birth family, and at the end of our seven-minute hearing on the telephone, he said, I am supposed to find just cause for allowing this person to have his birth certificate, and no one has told me what just cause means, and he's very frustrated with the experience too because the legislature isn't telling him how to determine what just cause is to release this document that many adoptees would like without this hassle.
Rudy Owens wrote the book, You Don't Know How Lucky You Are, An Adoptee's Journey Through the American Adoption Experience. Thanks for telling us about this problem that most of us weren't aware of.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
That's Stateside for today. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.